Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm Alex Linder. This is The Learning College, and today we are back with you, and we're going to do The Historic Basis of Jewish Imperialism, which is, I think, Chapter 9? Yes, Chapter 9 of Henry Ford's The International Jew, The World's Foremost Problem. And Henry Ford and his researchers at the Dearborn Independent said that back in 1920, when the vast series of articles appeared from which these four collected volumes that make up The International Jew, unabridged version, which we're doing here, were first put together. They were put together over about 91 weeks back in 1920, 21, or maybe it was 1920. And they attempted to cover or survey all aspects of the Jewish question and the Jewish problem, as it was called back then. And we've seen a lot of what plagues us today was in larval form. Not the Jews, but the Goyish publishing and understanding of it maybe was in a less advanced state than it should be today, whereas Jewish power has grown a lot greater. But exactly the same problems continue to plague us today. So, Chapter 9, The Historic Basis of Jewish Imperialism. And again, everything that we do as part of the Learning College can be found at vnnforum.com. I'm Alex Linder. It's my forum. You can contact me at alinder5@gmail.com. If you have questions, you're welcome to post the URL to the MP3 that we do here anywhere. Circulate them. It's free educational material, better than you can get in any accredited college out there, because it deals with stuff that the system won't, and that's indeed part of the problem that we're talking about, the leftist Jewish takeover of institutions. But back then, Henry Ford, a famous industrialist, started the car industry, essentially in the U.S. and the world, the automated production line. He was one of the first to really emphasize that high pay for workers. He was one of the first to do that. And he ran into Jews, he had some problems with them, and he came to understand that apart from capital and labor, there's a third body hovering over the scene, and that is finance. And he came to see that that was dominated by Jews, and he had his researchers for his Dearborn Independent, Dearborn, Michigan, Dearborn Independent being their paper, go out and research the Jewish question and write up reports on it over a long period of time. And so that's what we're dealing with here. Chapter 9, The Historic Basis of Jewish Imperialism, begins with an epigraph from Theodor Herzl in his A Jewish State, and that's the father of Zionism, the founder of modern Israel. We are a people, one people. When we sink, we become a revolutionary proletariat, the subordinate officers of a revolutionary party. When we rise, there rises also our terrible power of the purse. So Jewish financiers at the top and Jewish revolutionary scum below come together in a pincer movement to smash or crush or rip apart Goyish society as they pursue the political enactment of their anti-Gentilism. You know, you ever see that term anywhere, anti-Gentile? It would be the natural mirror to anti-Semitism, but apparently only anti-Semitism is a serious problem, and everyone is made to know that. To talk of Jewish control of the press, why, that's ridiculous conspiracy talk. Of course it isn't. Anti-Gentilism, or Loxism as I've called it, the hatred Jews have for whites and non-Jews generally, is the driving force of the modern world, and certainly the driving force behind the mass media. But you'll never read about it in papers owned and produced by Goyim, for Goyim, by Jews. So let's get on with the chapter. The historic basis of Jewish imperialism. A great unloosening of speech with reference to the Jewish question and the Jewish program for world power. And they make a distinction between power and control. Has occurred in this country since the beginning of this series of articles, which I mentioned earlier. It is now possible to pronounce the word Jew in a perfectly serious discussion, without timidity or without intimidation. Heretofore, that has been regarded as the special prerogative of the Jewish publicists themselves, and they have used the name exclusively in well-organized and favorable propaganda. They can oust portions of Shakespeare from the public schools. And again, this is 100 years ago, 95 years ago, from when I speak in 2015. They're already getting history and literature rewritten or bowdlerized in order to protect their sensitivities. They want themselves portrayed in only one way, as victims, as innocent, beset victims who are noble and ethical compared to the dirty, malicious goyim who hate them for absolutely no reason. That certainly has nothing to do with their historical behavior. This is the imposture they foist on the world. They can oust portions of Shakespeare from the public schools on the ground that the Jews are offended. They can demand the removal of one of Sargent's paintings from the Boston Library because it represents the synagogue in decline. But when anything emanates from the Gentile side, which indicates that the Gentile is also conscious of the Jew, then the charge of prejudice is instantly and strongly made. The effect of that in this country has been a ban on speech, which has had few parallels in our history. Recently, at a banquet, a speaker used the term Jews in reference to the actions of a group of Jewish bankers. A Jewish guest leaped to his feet, demanding to know if the speaker considered it American, quote-unquote, to single out a race that way. The speaker replied, "I do, sir," and received the approval of the audience. In that particular part of the country, businessmen's tongues had been tied for years by the unwritten law that Jews must never be singled out as Jews. So we're there to do what they do, that is, operate as a team against us, but we are never to mention it. Or we become anti-Semites, as they call it, and fair game for having our reputations and livelihoods destroyed. This is how Jews actually operate. They're a powerful, hostile, alien nation that has been allowed to live among our own because of the stupidity of Christianity, which insists on treating them as just another set of men who need conversion. And not a set of men so much as a bunch of individuals. Christianity makes no distinction between race and other race. It's all about converting and saving the individual and his soul. This blinds white men. Treat others the way you want to be treated yourself. Blinds them to the fact that these are not like us. They don't think like us. They don't behave like us. And they are hostile to us. The only rational way to treat Jews is as a hostile team, for which we need to form ourselves into a competing team, Team White, as I've styled it and used that hashtag on Twitter. No one would have predicted a year ago that a newspaper like the Chicago Tribune could have convinced itself that it was good newspaper policy to print in the first column of its first page a copyrighted article on the Jewish Program for World Rule, printing the word Jew in large letters in its headline, and abstaining from editorial retouching of the word Jew in the body of the article. The usual plan is to do what an Eastern newspaper did when dealing with the same subject. Wherever the term international Jew, in quotes, occurred in the article which it printed, it was retouched to financiers. Code word, but the overt definition or description is preferable to the code. The Chicago Tribune, however, on Saturday, June 19, 1920, printed in the first column of the first page a cable dispatch from John Clayton, its special correspondent, under the heading, "Trotsky leads Jew radicals to world rule. Bolshevism only a tool for his scheme." The first paragraph reads as follows. "For the last 2 years, Army intelligence officers, members of the various secret service organizations of the Entente, have been bringing in reports of a world revolutionary movement other than Bolshevism. At first, these reports confused the two, but latterly, the lines they have taken have begun to be more and more clear. As previously stated in the Dearborn Independent, our own secret services, one of these, though there is reason to believe that because of the influence of Jews upon the government, these investigations were not pursued with the persistency that might otherwise have been given them. However, we know from Jewish sources, not to mention any other, that the Department of Justice of the United States was at one time interested enough to make inquiries. So, back in 1920, at least one major paper was willing to print something about actual Jew plans for fomenting world revolution within a couple of years of the Jewish takeover of the Soviet Union. What the Tribune writer does in the above paragraph is to show that this interest has been sustained for 2 years by officials of the Entente, E-N-T-E-N-T-E, a fact which ought to be borne in mind by those who declare that the whole matter is of German instigation. The emergence of the Jewish question into American thought was immediately met by a statement from Jewish sources that it was a German importation, and that the anti-Semitism which flowed over Germany and resulted in cleaning out the overwhelmingly Jewish revolutionary influences from the new German government, that is, after the Kaiser abdicated and you had the various putsches around the country led by the Jewish communists who were trying to revolutionize Germany in the communist way as they had just succeeded in Russia. They were cleaned out by the free soldiers, who were the returning war veterans, who were nationalist and right-wing. And so Jews are blaming this, calling this anti-Semitism, and claiming that Germans are behind these lies about Jews trying to foment global communist activity and revolution. And the Jews are saying the emergence of the Jewish question in America was immediately met by a statement from Jewish sources that it was a German importation, and that the anti-Semitism that flowed over Germany and resulted in the overwhelming Jewish revolutionary influences from the new German government was only a trick to throw the blame for the defeat of Germany on the Jews. American rabbis are even now united in preaching that history shows that every great war is followed by a new attack on the Jews. It is undoubtedly, and they put attack in quotes, it is undoubtedly a fact that every new war newly opens the people's eyes to the power which international Jewish financiers exert with reference to war, and it would seem that such a fact is worthy of a better explanation than that of prejudice. However, as the Tribune article shows, and as well the facts confirm, the interest is not confined to the German side. Indeed, it is not even strongest there. It is, quote, the various secret service organizations of the Entente, unquote, that have been most active in the matter. Now, the Entente was an agreement between Britain and France, sort of resisting Germany. It means friendship, understanding, agreement in French, associated with World War I. The second paragraph further distinguishes between Bolshevism and Jewish imperialism. Block quote. Bolshevism aims at the overthrow of existing society and the establishment of an international brotherhood of men who work with their hands as rulers of the world. The second movement aims for the establishment of a new racial domination of the world. A new racial domination of the world. So far as the British, French, and our own departments' inquiry have been able to trace, the moving spirits in the second scheme are Jewish radicals. Other statements in the article are, within the ranks of communism is a group of this party, but it does not stop there. To its leaders, communism is only an incident. Other statements in the article are, within the ranks of communism is a group of this party, but it does not stop there. To its leaders, communism is only an incident. Oh, I guess I repeated that. Write down a note there. This will recall the statement of Lord Eustace Percy, quoted last week from the Canadian Jewish Chronicle. Not because the Jew cares for the positive side of radical philosophy, not because he desires to be a partaker in Gentile nationalism or Gentile democracy, but because no existing Gentile system of government is anything but distasteful to him. They are ready to use the Islamic revolt, hatred by the Central Empires for England, Japan's designs on India, and commercial rivalry between America and Japan, these are all direct quotes in a block quote, as any movement of world revolution must be, this is primarily an anti-Anglo-Saxon. The organization of the World Jewish Radical Movement has been perfected in almost every land. The aims of the Jewish Radical Party have nothing of altruism behind them beyond liberation of their own race. It will be conceded that these are rather startling statements. If they were found in a propagandist publication of no responsibility, the average reader might pass them by as preposterous. So little does the average reader know of the secret influences which shape his life and frame his problems. But appearing in a great newspaper, they must receive a different evaluation. Nor did the Tribune stop at the news article. On June 21, 1920, an editorial appeared entitled World Mischief. The editorial is evidently an effort to prevent possible misunderstanding of what the news article was driving at. The Jewish phase of the movement, he asserts, aims at a new racial domination of the world. A new racial domination of the world. The Tribune also says that while it is perhaps natural for the Jews of other countries to be engaged in this world mischief, the Jews of England and the United States are loyal nationalists and conservative upholders of the national traditions. It were well if this were true. Perhaps it is true of the tens of thousands of Jews as individuals. It certainly is not true of those internationalists who pull the strings of all the governments and who, during the last six tragic years, have been meddling with world affairs in a way which must be soon be plainly told. The unfortunate circumstances is that all American and English Jews must for a time feel a distress which no one desires them to feel, which everyone would do much to save them from, but which seems inevitable until the whole story is told and until the mass of Jews themselves cut off from their name and support some who now receive their deepest homage. So there are some loyal Jews, but the international ones are pulling the strings of the governments, and they have the support of a lot of the Jews, and there's going to be some pain involved in bringing this problem to light and solving it. But they weren't able to do that, as it turned out. It is worthwhile observing the contrasts and similarities between the Jewish and Gentile reaction to this alleged movement to establish a Jewish imperialism over the world. Jewish publicists first deny it without qualification. It is all false, all a lie, all hatched up by the enemies of the Jews in order to stir up hatred and murder. As the evidence accumulates, the Jewish tone changes. Well, suppose it is true, the publicists say. Is it any wonder that the poor oppressed Jews, driven to madness through their sufferings, should dream of dreams of overthrowing their enemies and placing themselves in the seat of authority? The Gentile mind, confronted with the statement, says, yes, but they are Russian Jews. Don't mind them. American Jews are all right. They would never be taken in by anything like that. Going a little deeper into the subject, the Gentile mind is forced to admit the existence of some kind of a subversive world movement, the power of which has shaken even this country, and that the moving spirits in it are revolutionary Jews, and then the tendency from that point forward is either to fall in with the theory that the movement is really Jewish in origin, agitation, execution, and purpose, or to set up the theory that it is a world government, undoubtedly, but only incidentally Jewish. The end of both Jewish and Gentile reaction is an admission that something answering to the movement charged actually exists. For example, the Christian Science Monitor, whose standard is a newspaper no one will question, again, it was independent of the church, although owned by them, has this to say in a lengthy editorial on the subject. Quote, in spite of this, it would be a tremendous mistake to conclude that the Jewish peril, given another name and atmosphere, does not exist. It would be a tremendous mistake to conclude that the Jewish peril does not exist. How about that? It might indeed be renamed out of one of the grandest books of the Old Testament, The Terror by Night, for it is essentially the psalmist's conception of the forces of mental evil at which, consciously or unconsciously, Professor Nihlus is aiming, and that's the name under which the Protocols was published. In other words, that a secret international political organization exists, working unremittingly by means of its Bureau of Psychology through the world, though the world, which should be awake to it, is entirely asleep to it, is, to the man who can read the signs of the times, a thing unquestionable. The Monitor gives warning against prejudice and disregard of the laws of evidence, which is exceedingly timely and is, indeed, the desire of anyone who has ever undertaken to deal with this subject, but too often it is a disregard of facts and not of evidence that makes the difficulty. It is safe to say that most of the prejudice today is against the facts. It has not been caused by them. And again, we are spending all of our time here disclaiming any badness in our motives. So instead of focusing on the Jews, we're spending all of our time in this investigation of the Jews talking about our motives and being painstaking in trying to separate good Jews from bad and acknowledging that not all of them are doing this. And it really weakens the cause because it needs to be completely focused on this horrible evil that Jews are up to. And if some of the innocent fall under the bus, they don't care about any of us because they say that all of us are guilty. And you're bringing a knife to a gunfight when you're sitting there splitting hairs over their individual guilt. But this is how it was back then. We see a lot of the same problem today. There are two preconceptions to be guarded against in making an approach to this question. One is that the Jewish imperialistic program, if such a thing exists, is of recent origin. Upon the mere mention of such a program, Gentiles are likely to think that it was formulated last week, or last year, or within recent time. That need not be the case at all. And in Jewish matters, it is very likely not to be the case. It is very easy to see how, if the program were to be formulated today, it would be wholly different from the one which is to be considered. The kind of program that would be made today indeed exists too, but it is not to be compared in extent and profundity with that which has existed for a very long time. Perfect constitutions of invisible governments are not the creations of secret conventions. They are the accumulated thought and experience of centuries. Perfect constitutions of invisible governments are not the creations of secret conventions. They are the accumulated thought and experience of centuries. So they know how to work with each other. They don't even need to communicate or write stuff down because they know what the other is thinking. They just need occasionally to touch base because they're so accustomed to working with one another over the centuries. Moreover, no matter how prone a modern generation may be to disregard such things, the mere fact that they may have existed as a secret racial ideal for centuries is a powerful argument for their respectable acceptance, if not active execution, by a generation that now is. There is no idea deeper in Judaism than that Jews constitute a chosen people and that their future is to be more glorious than their past. A large part of the Christian world accepts that, too, and it may well be true, but in a moral universe it cannot come to pass by the methods which have been and are being used. Let's repeat that again. That's pretty important. There is no idea deeper in Judaism than that the Jews constitute a chosen people and that their future is to be more glorious than their past. And they're willing to ride roughshod over any other group to attain that. Make it real. But to mention the ancient lineage of the idea of the chosen people is merely to suggest that of all the programs they may have gathered round to assist its full historical realization, it is not strange that there should be one very old one to which the wisest minds of Israel have contributed their best of mind and heart to ensure its success. That there is such a plan has been the belief of many deep delvers in the hidden things of the world, and that such a plan has at times had its dress rehearsals, so to speak, on a limited stage, as if in preparation for its grand finale on the universal stage, is another belief held by men at whose knowledge it is impossible to cavil. So, those who investigate Jews hold these feelings more strongly than those who haven't investigated that there is this Jewish plan for a new racial domination of the world, and it's been underway, it's been their dream and their view, and they've been working toward it for centuries. So then, it may be that we are dealing with something for which present-day Jews, even the more important internationalists, are not originally responsible. It may have come to them as part of their ancient Jewish inheritance. Certainly, if it were a mere modern thing, hastily conceived and thrown together after the modern fashion, it could be expected to disappear in the same era which saw it born. Another preconception to be guarded against is that every Jew one meets has secret knowledge of this program. That is not the case. With the general idea of the ultimate triumph of Israel, every Jew who has retained contact with his people is familiar, but with the special plans which for centuries have existed in formulated form for the attainment of that triumph, the average Jew is no more familiar than anyone else, no more so than was the average German with the secret plans of the Pan-Germanic Party whose ideas started and guided the recent war. That's, again, an opinion that is not likely to be true. The average Jew, I mean about the Pan-Germanic Party, the average Jew enters into the plans of the secret group just to this extent, especially in specially selected cases. It is perfectly understood that the consummation of the Jewish triumph will not be distasteful to any Jew, and if the methods to be used toward the end are a bit violent, every Jew can be depended upon to see in that violence a very insufficient retribution visited upon the Gentile world for the sufferings which it has caused the sons of Judah throughout the centuries. Still, with even these preconceptions guarded against, there is no escape from the conclusion that if such a program of Jewish world imperialism exists today, it must exist with the cognizance and active support of certain individuals, and that these groups of individuals must have somewhere an official head, So there is a plan, it does exist. Not all Jews are familiar with it, but all will benefit from it, and all have been taught and trained and believe that Goyim have persecuted them through the centuries, so whatever happens to them, they deserve. And I'll benefit from it anyway, thinks the average Jew. But that doesn't mean they're aware of the plan, particulars, or even necessarily that there is a plan other than the general sense that Israel will overcome all and rule all. That's its destiny. This is perhaps the one point at which more investigators stop than any other, that is, naming actual names. The idea of a Jewish autocrat is too strange for the mind which has not been in contact with the main question. And yet there is no race which more instinctively supports autocracy than does the Jewish race, no race which more craves and respects position. It is their sense of the value of position that explains the main course their activities take. The Jew is primarily a moneymaker for the reason that up to this time, money is the only means he knows by which to gain position. The Jews who have gained position for any other reason are comparatively few. This is not a Gentile jibe. It is the position of a famous Anglo-Jewish physician, Dr. Bernard von Oven. B-A-R-N-A-R-D, von Oven. I kid you not. Who wrote, a famous Anglo-Jewish physician. He wrote, all other means of distinction are denied him. He must rise by wealth or not at all. And if, as he well knows, to ensure wealth will be to ensure rank, that is, he can buy his way into the social elite, respect and attention in society, does the blame rest with him who endeavors to acquire wealth for the distinction which it will purchase, or with that society which so readily bows down to the shrine of mammon, as in England, where they allow them to buy peerages, as they're called. They can buy titles of nobility in England, which you should not be allowed to do, because those are supposed to be by blood, for blood-based leadership. The Jew is not averse to kings, only to the state of things which prevents a Jewish king. The future autocrat of the world is to be a Jewish king sitting upon the throne of David, so ancient prophecies and the documents of the imperialistic program agree. So they're going to have a one world, going to be led by a Jew. He'll sit on the throne of David, and that will fulfill ancient prophecies. Is there such a king in the world now? If not, the men who could choose a king are in the world. There has been no king of the Jews since before the Christian era, but until about the 11th century there were princes of the exile, those who represented the headship of the Jews, who were dispersed through the nations. They were and still are called exilarchs, E-X-I-L-A-R-C-H-S, or princes of the exile. They were attended by the wise men of Israel. They held court. They gave the law to their people. They lived abroad, wherever their circumstances or convenience dictated, in Christian or Mohammedan countries. Whether the office was discontinued with the last publicly known exilarch or merely disappeared from the surface of history, whether today it is entirely abandoned or exists in another form, are questions which must wait. That there are offices of world jurisdiction held by Jews is well known. That there are world organizations of Jews, organizations, that is, within the very strong solidarity of the Jewish nation itself, is well known. That there is world unity on certain Jewish activities, defensive and offensive, is well known. There is nothing in the condition or thought of the Jews which would render the existence today of an exilarch distasteful to them. Indeed, the thought would be very comfortable. So Jews are well organized, and if they have, seem to have abandoned exilarchs, that may be merely on the surface, because the same patterns and interests are there. The Jewish Encyclopedia remarks, curiously enough, the exilarchs are still mentioned in the Sabbath services of the Ashkenazim ritual. Remember, 90% of Jews are Ashkenazi. The Jews of the Sephardic ritual have not preserved this anachronism, nor was it retained in most of the Reform synagogues of the 19th century. Is there, then, a Jewish Sanhedrin, that is a council of the elders, a governing or counseling bodies of Jews who take oversight of the affairs of their people throughout the world? The Jewish Sanhedrin was a most interesting institution. Its origin and method of constitution are obscure. It consisted of 71 members with a president and performed the functions of a political senate. There is nothing to show whence the Sanhedrin derived its authority. It was not an elective body. It was not democratic. It was not representative. It was not responsible to the people. In these qualities, it was typically Jewish. The Sanhedrin was chosen by the prince, or priest, not with the purpose of safeguarding the people's interest, but to assist the ruler in the work of administration. It was thus assembled by call, or it was self-perpetuating, calling its own members. The arrangement seems to have been that well-known device by which an aristocracy can maintain itself in power, to have been that well-known device by which an The arrangement seems to have been that well-known device by which an aristocracy can maintain itself in power, whatever the political construction of the nation may be. The Jewish Encyclopedia says, "The Sanhedrin, which was entirely aristocratic in character, probably assumed its own authority, since it was composed of members of the most influential families of the nobility and priesthood. The body was flanked by a similar body, which governed the religious interests of the nation, the members being drawn apparently from classes nearer the common people. The Sanhedrin exercised authority not only over the Jews of Palestine, but wherever they were scattered throughout the world. As a senate exercising direct political authority, it ceased with the downfall of the Jewish state in the year 70, but there are indications of its continuance as an advisory body down to the 4th century. In 1806, in order to satisfy the mind of Napoleon upon some questions which had arisen concerning the Jews, an assembly of notables was called, whose membership consisted of prominent Jews of France. They, in turn, to bring the sanction of all Jewry to the answers which they should give Napoleon, convoke the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin assembled in Paris on February 9, 1807. It followed the prescribed ancient forms. It was comprised of Jews from all parts of Europe. It was assembled to put the whole authority of Jewry behind any compact the French Jews may have been able to make with Napoleon. In putting forth its decisions, this Sanhedrin of 1807 declared that it was in all respects, like the ancient Sanhedrin, quote, a legal assembly vested with the power of passing ordinances in order to promote the welfare of Israel. The significance of these facts is this. Whatever the leaders of Jews may do today in the way of maintaining the policy and constitution of Israel would not constitute a new departure. It would not signify a new attitude. It would not be evidence of a new plan. It would be entirely natural, Jewish solidarity being what it is, that the Sanhedrin should still be continued. The ancient Sanhedrin appears to have had a group of 10 who were somewhat exalted in importance above the rest. It would be perfectly natural if the leaders of the Jews were today divided into committees, by countries or by objects. There are always being held, year by year, world meetings of the principal Jews of all lands. They come together, whenever called, to the disregard of everything else. Great judges from the high courts of the various countries, international financiers, Jewish orators of the liberal type, who have the ear of the Gentiles, political maneuvers from all the parties represented in the world, they assemble wherever they will, and the subjects of their deliberations are made known only to the extent they will. It is not to be supposed that all of the attendants on these conventions are members of the inner circle. The list of delegates will show scores of persons with whom no one would associate Lord Reading and Judge Brandeis. If the modern Sanhedrin meets, and it would be the most natural thing in the world if it should, we may be sure it meets within the closed circles of those persons which the Jewish aristocracy of money, intellect, and power approves. The machinery of a Jewish world government exists ready-made. The Jew is convinced that he has the best religion, the best morality, the best method of education, the best social standards, the best ideal of government. He would not have to go outside the circle of that which he considers the best to get anything which he may need to advance the welfare of his people or to execute any program which may have to do with the outside world. It is the ancient machinery that the international Jew uses in all those activities which he permits the world to see in part. There are gatherings of the financial, political, and intellectual chief rulers of the Jews. These gatherings are announced for one or another thing, sometimes. Sometimes there is a gathering of Jews in a world capital with no announced purpose. They all appear in one city, confer, and depart. Whether there is a recognized head to all of this is yet to be disclosed. There could be little doubt, however, as to the existence of what may be called a foreign policy, that is, a definite point of view and a plan of action with reference to the Gentile world. The Jew feels that he is in the midst of enemies, but he also feels that he is a member of a people, one people. He must have some policy with regard to the outer world. He cannot help but consider present conditions. He cannot consider them without being stirred to speculate upon what the outcome must be. And he cannot speculate on the outcome without in some manner endeavoring to make it as he would like it to be. The invisible government of the Jews, its attitude toward the Gentile world, its policy with regard to the future, are not, then, the abnormal things that some would make them appear. Given the Jewish position, they are, of all things, most natural. Jewish existence in this world is not such as woos the Jew into sleepy contentment. It is such as stirs him into organization against future contingencies and into programs which may shape those contingencies to the benefit of his race. That there should be a Sanhedrin of the Jews, a world body of the leading men of all countries, that there should even be an exilarch, a visible and recognized head of the Sanhedrin, mystically foreshadowing it, the autocrat to come, that there should even be a world program, just as every government has its foreign policy, are not strange, uncanny suppositions. They grow naturally out of the situation itself. And it is also natural that not every Jew should know this. The Sanhedrin always was the aristocracy and would be today. When rabbis cry from their pulpits that they know nothing about this thing, they are doubtless telling the truth. What the international Jew depends upon is the likelihood of every Jew approving that which brings power and prestige to his people. At any rate, it is well enough known that, however little the ordinary Jewish leader may have been told about world programs, he regards with greatest respect and confidence the very men who put these programs through, if these exist at all. The 24th Protocol of the Learned Elders of Zion has this to say: Now I will discuss in the manner in which the roots of the house of King David will penetrate to the deepest strata of the earth. This dynasty, even to this day, has given power of controlling world affairs to our wise men, the educational directors of all human thought. How about that? This would indicate, if reliable, that, as the protocol goes on to recite, the autocrat himself has not appeared, but the dynasty, or the Davidic line in which he must appear, have entrusted the work of preparing him for him to the wise men of Zion. These wise men are represented not only as preparing those who exercise rulership over Judaism's affairs, but also as framing and influencing the world's thought towards ends which shall be propitious to these plans. Whatever may be hidden in the program, it is certain that its execution or the effects of its execution cannot be hidden. Therefore, it may be possible to find in the outer world the clues which, traced back to their source, reveal the existence of a program whose promise for the world, good or bad, ought to be widely known. And that's their transition from talking about, basically, historically, Jews have been extremely organized, and they talk about the Sanhedrin, and they talk about just the fact that Jews are organized, and the heads of their organizations meet frequently and internationally, and they do see themselves as a global race, and their people do prophesy when they will rule overall. And it's going to move from that in this chapter to the protocols next chapter as we try to trace out facts in the world, since they may be able to hide their leadership stratum, but they can't hide their plan when they try to put it into execution. And that's what we'll talk about next. So thanks for being with me today. You can find everything we do at vnnforum.com. I'm Alex Linder, and I've been reading to you out of The Unabridged, The International Jew, which has 4 volumes. This was Chapter 9, The Historic Basis of Jewish Imperialism. I'll be back with you again real soon.